Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. Fred and I are talking about a project we're working on together for Ascender, which is the reliability body of knowledge and what that should, and perhaps more importantly, should not be.
Well, we can make a document or a PDF or whatever. And that's, I think, what it's one of its flavors at some point or another. It might be published in a variety of different ways. That's what it is. But what should it, I think, is what's it, what should it do for somebody that reads it or consumes it? Doing that kind of work in writing a body of knowledge, what is its purpose? What should change in our industry because it exists? Mm-hmm. Or what should it support or change or mold or guide? Or what is it that concept supposed to do? And one of the things that sparked this discussion is in our last episode, we mentioned, knowing what a Raleigh distribution is and when and why you would use it. And I'm thinking of the ASQ body of knowledge, which I've used for years and years and years for all kinds of reasons and purposes. And I remember sitting in body of knowledge discussions as committees, they get together every 5 years or so to go over what should be in the body of knowledge. And they put a constraint on what's in there is things that you can test. So they'll have the Weibull distribution, and so because you can test that a beta less than one means this, and a beta greater than one means that something different. But I said, why don't we put in the body of knowledge is why and when would you use a Weibull distribution? When is it appropriate to use that in your analysis? Well, that's harder to test. We need like an essay or a casework for that, and that's too expensive. So we don't focus on those concepts. That's assumed. And I'm like, well, that's the difference between a good reliability engineer or just somebody that turns the crank and gives you a may or may not be a useful analysis.
Well, they're talking about a document or a book that allows someone to go away and study it and pay for them to get that book to study, to go and do a test that allows them to be certified as good or bad.
Well, it's not even good or bad because they don't tell you that. It's not a professional license at all. It just means that you pass this test on this particular day and that you committed to doing professional development so you don't have to sit for the test again. And you pay a fee every 3 years, one to take the test and every 3 years to maintain that certification. It's a money-making thing for professional societies in the way they've set it up. And one of the complaints early on I heard about the CRE is that it's the most difficult test. And what do you mean it's most difficult? Is it the stuff we're doing just that more advanced than what other fields are doing? And he goes, no, is that it has the lowest pass rate. And he says, okay, is that a problem of the body of knowledge or the test? Or is that a problem of our industry? Or why is that a problem? He says, well, if you don't pass the test, then you don't pay the recertification fees every 3 years for the rest of your life. It was a problem because they didn't make enough money on it.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, this doesn't sound like a very logical thing to be doing. I think the initial concept of bodies of knowledge, like in mechanical engineering or the professional licensing type things, is this is the types of concepts you need to know in order to create safe and efficient designs, whether you're an architect or building a bridge. These are the concepts that you need to be familiar with so that you can do your job well. And I think when you constrain the body of knowledge to saying, well, this is easy to test, then I think you missed the point. It's the horse and cart in the wrong order kind of thing.
And let's pile on the body of knowledge in particular, at least some of the interpretations of the body of knowledge, like the primers, for example. Mm-hmm. We teach courses on how to pass the exam, so we're pretty familiar with what is in there and what's not in there. Mm-hmm. But there's no consistency in the messaging of the reference documents either. You look at you can clearly see different sections written by different people. You'll see the same concept defined in different ways. It's depending on which chapter or which part of it, which body of knowledge you're reading in the same document, which then just smacks of just a vomit of ideas, testable ideas. And when it comes time to answering the questions, you, especially the example questions, you realize, hang on, the answers here don't make sense to me, and I'm supposed to be teaching this course, and you've got students saying, hey, I got this answer wrong. You go, well, that beats me. I'm sorry. That's having redundancy doesn't beat common cause failure. That's a classic one in one of the primer test questions. Yeah. If you have common cause failure, you can have 100 redundant components, but that common cause is going to cause failure. But yes, you would have got it wrong if you answered the question in any other way. It's just insane. It's not well put together.
Well, my intent was not to talk about how bad existing bodies of knowledge is, but I think we could go off on that tangent for quite a ways. But the idea I think the underlying initial purpose of a body of knowledge, independent of whether it's the CRE or anybody else's, is to lay out, well, here's the types of things you need to be proficient in or be familiar with and be competent in applying in order to have the title of a certified reliability engineer, for example. And there's a laundry list of concepts and ideas, everything from, a trading off reliability versus cost versus time to market, those kind of business management, project management type stuff. You need to be able to work with other people. You need to do statistical data analysis. You need to do FMEAs or HALT or accelerated testing or these other concepts. You need to understand how maintenance fits in to the design of a product and how you actually accomplish maintenance. And so one of the things I hear from many of the students I've taught over the years is that I'm doing this because I've been working as a reliability engineer, but I only work in this area of the field. And I want to know, I know there's more to it, and the body of knowledge exposed me to other things that will help me be a better engineer. And it's a good cause, a good purpose of a body of knowledge is to say, here's the breadth of things you should be familiar with. And on my on-the-job experience, I might only be familiar with some aspects of that and not be conscious of the full range that's out there. And so I think from a professional development side and from a learning process, having a framework or a structure or a listing of the range of tools and activities that are available to you is a good thing. I think that's a noble purpose of a body of knowledge. But I also think it should be more than that. I think it shouldn't just be a listing.
Right. So, I mean, we talked about that continuum I proposed for framing this conversation. If you're at one end of a continuum, the continuum, you have, a simple, practical how-to guidebook sort of document. At the other end, you have an encyclopedia or an almanac, which covers every conceivable thing you might be exposed to in reliability engineering. And we don't want it to be, the guidebook where, for example, for HALT, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this, sort of follow the bouncing ball. Yes, there's some thinking involved, but not as much as you need to go through when you're talking about, how do I put together a reliability plan or program, for example?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I think we need the recipes as a vehicle for learning how to do HALT, but I think it's not what I find a problem in the handbooks is it says, go to the lab, apply these stresses in a step stress fashion and see what falls out and do failure analysis. And it's a basic recipe for HALT, right? And it's wrong. I think if you do that, you will probably get it wrong. You will not learn what you need to learn. It should start with, this is the concept of HALT. This is what it does. And then here's the thinking steps you need to take so that you pick the right stresses to apply. Just because that's the chamber that's available that has the great big banner over the top saying HALT chamber doesn't mean that you're limited to a HALT chamber. That's not HALT. That's not the concept. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you use a particular tool. It means you use a particular thought process. And that's where I run into a problems with bodies of knowledge is that they use the Bloom's taxonomy and they say, oh, you need to think about this stuff, but then they don't provide any reference or examples or guidance on, well, what does that thinking involve? What do I need to know to be able to think this way? Right? You need to be able to, at the highest level, innovate and apply the concept of HALT. Right? Mm-hmm. But then it stops. There's nothing else after that. And it's like, so I think there's a bit more in that realm to help people understand a body of knowledge is, well, what is it that I'm supposed to be thinking about here?
Well, and we talked about in the previous podcast too, how perhaps our industry is letting everyone down in terms of it being too much one way or too much the other way. So you either have the sort of, what's the right words I'm looking for here? Someone who is really focused on a particular way of doing something. And when they write textbooks or when they advocate for guidebooks, it's all about the way they do it. Here is a bouncing ball. You plug this number in, you download this probability plotting software, you put these numbers in, and out comes goodness. That's at one end. Now, the other end are the university professors who, quite frankly, don't get it and don't want to get it because their domain is to continually find things they find fascinating, which has limited relevance to the rest of the world. By definition, that's what they're doing because every new journal article has to be something new and different, which is essentially, that is a strategy towards eccentricity, if I've ever heard one.
Whatever is... The ivory tower comes to mind, you know, it's kind of, all right, you go play over there. You know, and every now and then there's a breakthrough or there's some interesting novel idea or process that comes out of that. But I, going into the block diagrams and Petri nets have so many variations and nuances and everything else on it that you could write textbook after textbook after textbook on it. Yet they lose sight of where it's actually useful.
Right. The decision you're trying to inform.
Yeah.
So there's that middle ground, which is currently vacant, you might suggest, where it teaches you how to think versus how to do a very prescribed activity or just general knowledge about everything you could possibly do. There's that middle ground that I think needs to be.
Yeah, and that's a hard part because there's – one of the purposes of embodied knowledge is to say, well, this is what it means to be with this title. You know, so if you're a reliability engineer and you're familiar and competent with this span of tick techniques and concepts and everything else, then you can say you're a reliability engineer. Except in Canada, where you can't be an engineer without a license. So, or I think rest of the world besides the U.S., you can be a consultant, but some other thing. But you, whatever. The idea though is that I think there's a value in knowing what is the span of knowledge that you should have, and just being aware of it. I think one of the roles of embodied knowledge is to increase awareness of what's involved. But it's like, sort of like being a medical doctor in an anatomy class, and you have to memorize every name of every bone, muscle, and ligament kind of thing, right? That serves a purpose of being familiar. It's not that you know the Latin for every item in the body, is that you've focused on it and you know where, you know that there's a lot of things and how they're connected and all that kind of stuff. But the purpose of that is to know how an injury here is related to other parts of the body. It has a different purpose. So just a list serves an initial purpose of creating awareness, but that's not sufficient. And I think that's where that middle ground comes in is, well, how do you define sufficient? How do I know enough? And I think the body of knowledge needs to provide that structure as much or more so than here's a list of the 20 distributions.
Well, we both ex-military, so you see the military example. We both I dare say you can recall the same lessons I was part of when we taught us how to use an assault rifle. Mm-hmm. There were lessons where you had to memorize the length, the mass, the firing rate, the magazine capacities, you had to memorize all this tabulated data about a rifle. And that's,
yeah. We had some dignitary, I don't know, some senator or something like that was going to come review the troops or do this kind of thing. And so the excruciating part was all the captains and majors and lieutenant colonels preparing us as soldiers for this meeting. And they grilled us on all that stuff, all the facts, all the details, all this other stuff. And one of the guys, and this is a story I heard about, but they were over in the air defense segment of it. And so this dignitary is, you know, the suited guy, and he's got his entourage and all the staff, everybody's in front of him, and they're all clustered around this private in this air defense unit. And he's got this whiz bang new piece of equipment, and he knew everything. They briefed him for, you know, weeks in preparation of this meeting. He knew all this stuff. And so this dignitary comes up and goes, there's a MiG-24 right over there. What do you do? And he goes, I'll come back in a half an hour and shoot him or something like that.
Yep.
Because he gave him an honest answer. He says, well, that's not one of the hostiles, so I'll just ignore him or something like that. It's like, they're our allies. or something. He did some flippant answer. Yep. And you could see the entire brass, all the staff just kind of went, oh.
Yeah.
We just don't get it.
And that's just, you know, that's a sad reality of how we teach people. You see, we confuse quantity with any sort of value. I mean, I used to know how heavy those rifles were. And I also knew they tended to get heavier the longer the exercise went.
Yeah.
I also knew that they were not as heavy to me as they were to some other people. it's useless. At the other end of it, you can have people who really teach you how to shoot the rifle really well. You can lie down on your belly in the prone position, and you can take the time to really
think about breathing. I remember that. Yeah, and just, you know, how to use a sight. The guys from Kentucky were the best. They said, you got to take care of windage. Well, what's windage?
Exactly, and that's a really cool skill to learn. But you and I both know that in the heat of battle, you're not going to be able to lie down comfortably on a nice piece flat of terrain, get your breathing right, and I suppose more importantly, have the bad dude you're shooting at stay in exactly the same position, so you don't need to adjust your fire position. That doesn't happen either. There's that middle ground. You need to understand how to, yes, what effects the rifle has and how to employ it in a really strategic way. That would eventually come. You know, of course, that was a lot of training ended up being. But I just remember at the time, you're going, okay, why do I need to know this is exactly that many kilograms? And this breathing is really good, and I can see that I can get a group size about 70 millimeters at 300 meters, which is great, but we're in the shade, I'm on a padded thing, I'm taking my time breathing, the target's not moving, it's just, all right, let's do this.
Yeah, it's not real. But yeah, later we did patrols and we did ambushes and we did all kinds of other stuff. Luckily I got to do all that stuff without live fire, which puts another level of realism on it. And then, but it's part of it is, I think, in the body of knowledge that, I mean, if I had never thought about hypothesis testing, if I didn't have a degree or a boss that decided that I needed to know that, I wouldn't know that that's a tool to do comparison. So when the electrical engineer comes up and says, well, there's two vendors that say they have the same solution, how do we compare those? You know, which one's going to be better for us from a reliability point of view? I'm like, well, I don't know. Let's look at the data sheet. I think having the ability to go, well, we can run an experiment on that. Here's the type of tool we can use to make that kind of comparison. Or here's the range of options we have given this set of constraints. It's that higher level thinking parts that is, to me, the middle ground. Is I need to understand how to use a handful of different tools, but I also need to understand when I need to go get a different one, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes my rifle is just not going to do the job. I need a 155 millimeter howitzer.
Yeah.
They're just way more fun to shoot, by the way.
Yeah, they need more people, though, and they're not as fast to try onto a different target. So they have their own drawbacks, but if you want to take out an entire feature...
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You can shoot at something with a 7.6, whatever. Now you're making me withdraw up information I learned 40 years ago.
7.62?
Yeah, that one. I could shoot that all day long at a steel bridge, and it won't do anything. But I can take out the foundation with a howitzer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, we talked about the Riley distribution in particular. One of those things that does appear in textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who want to look into it a bit deeper, a form of the Riley distribution is a Weibull distribution with parameter shape 2. Now, why does anyone realistically need to know that? How many actual reliability engineering problems has that solved? Ever.
Well, if you want to sound really sophisticated, say, well, we fit this to a Raleigh distribution. And nobody wants to ask the question, well, what's that? Because then they sound stupid. Then you can daze and amaze your friends at a cocktail party and says, yeah, we were doing some Raleigh distribution analysis today. Okay.
What sort of friends do you keep?
we sit around talking about kurtosis at breakfast.
Oh, you're saying, that's right. Yeah. We are in different circles then, Fred.
But the idea is that the other piece of this, and I don't want to forget it, is one of the purposes of body of knowledge is to help people do their job better. It's not just a recipe book. And I think we agree on that. But it's also, how do you progress in your career? How do you move forward? It should be prescriptive in my mind to say, here's how you approach and solve problems so that you add value, as opposed to here's 47 different ways to solve different kinds of problems. Good luck.
Yeah. The Mill Handbook approach to reliability.
Yeah. Okay.
So I do think there is a place for a textbook, and that's one of the things I'll be working on. There is a place for a textbook out there because I do think that beyond the body of knowledge thing, there is also a need for us to have, we do like to have central repositories of information, encyclopedias, almanacs, whatever you want to call them, so that if you do come across something quite unique or something unexpected, there is a trusted resource for you to go and learn about that thing.
Oh, yeah, But that's the key, though, Chris, is that you need to know that that's different or unique. You don't always do an X bar R chart in every process that you ever want to manage the process control. And right, you don't always use a Weibull analysis. Always. It's there are places where it's not appropriate. And so you need to know enough to know those constraints and assumptions.
Which is where the body of knowledge would potentially be. That guide.
I think it's more important for the body of knowledge to frame how you approach solving problems or providing information, as opposed to that you know these 47 different techniques.
Exactly. And and sometimes having an 80% solution now, or an 80% solution which is robust in its underlying assumptions, is better than the 100% solution, which took you 2 weeks longer to get, or 100% solution where you don't understand how you got there. Mm-hmm. It's all about what the decision is you're trying to help inform, I suppose.
Well, I think it comes down to that we work it's a thinking project. We're not putting nuts on bolts every day for a job. And that's an mm-hmm. important tool, activity that needs to be done. Yeah, but that's not what we're doing. We're influencing decisions. And so I think keeping that in focus is critical to me in a body of knowledge. So anyway, I feel like I should go rant on some of the other ones some more, but I think I'll save that for another venue, another opportunity. But the idea here is that, you know, Chris and I are working on a body knowledge, and we're struggling with the various purposes of it, needs and intents of it, and how it's used, and for all kinds of reasons. And so if you've got some opinions on what's good, bad, or ugly about existing body knowledges, or what would you look for, and if it's what we're talking about makes sense to you, let us know. Or not, if it's, you know, it's, we don't need another one, we'd like to hear from that too. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can get a contact form there with us. Our about pages include contact forms and contact information like email and phone numbers and stuff like that. Plus, you can find us on LinkedIn, and we keep track of all of those things in order to respond to your questions as quick as possible. But more importantly, or in addition to that, is we also use a lot of that information then to frame future episodes of the podcast. So please do join the discussion, and hopefully this is all kind of making sense for you. And we look forward to your ideas and comments. So with that, Chris, I think we need to get back to work.
Yeah.
It's been too much fun. Too much fun.
Well, we're just procrastinating from writing out this body of knowledge.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Chris. I'm sure we'll be back on this topic and others similar to it in the near future.
Absolutely. Well, until next time, Fred, have a good one.
You too. Cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.